when Edward was supported to move into a host approach and he was able to have kind of individualized support and choose what his environment looked like and felt like for him, his behaviors of concern actually were eradicated, so he no longer has or requires a behavior support plan.
Yes, there are peculiar and, you know, really fantastic specific things about the WA context, which Nicole can talk to you about, but it's not those that are absolutely integral to making this fly. Hosts and housemates, absolutely possible in the scheme at the moment, doesn't need legislative change, needs conviction and prioritisation by the scheme.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Solaforis, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, a Australia's premier podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and paying my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell, so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, I'm joined by Sam Bennett from the Grattan Institute, and I just released a report that challenges the way home and living supports are currently provided under the NDIS. I'm also joined by Nicole Cox from My Place. They're an organisation that has been supporting people with disabilities to establish and maintain really individualised arrangements for almost 30 years. So how can we help more people with disabilities escape from the group home model and live more inclusive lives in the community? Let's find out. Hi, Sam and Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, George.
Hi, George.
Let's start with some introductions. Can I start with you, Sam?
Certainly you can. Great to be here, George. Thanks so much for having me. I'm joining you from the unceded lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation here in Bayside in Melbourne today. I'm the program director from Grattan Institute's disability program. Grattan is Australia's foremost independent public policy think tank focused on domestic public policy issues. And I'm delighted that and very privileged that I've had the opportunity to be the leader of its first disability program in these last 12 months.
Welcome, Sam. Nicole.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me. I am joining from the beautiful country of the Wadjuk Noongar people. I'd like to extend my acknowledgements to the traditional owners and protectors of these gorgeous lands and waters. I am a manager and an executive director at an organisation called My Place. We support 400 individuals to live in their own homes across Perth and regional WA.
Excellent. Very excited to hear about, learn about in a second, Nicole. Sam, you've just released a report that says that we're failing NDIS participants when it comes to housing and support. Can you talk us through the evidence that the report has uncovered to lead you to come to this conclusion?
Certainly, George. Look, well, I think no one would dispute that people that need NDIS housing and living supports are really the people that need the scheme the most. These are folks with severe and profound lifelong disability, need a lot of support during the day, need some support overnight. Most commonly people with intellectual disability, but lots of other disabilities too. And what we know about this group is that a large number of them are still living in group homes. And group homes is where people are living under one roof, sharing support, often still in some quite large group homes, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, but in other parts of Australia too. And they typically don't have good choice and control over who they live with, who's providing their support, and how that support is provided. And the Disability Royal Commission, people will recall, went into some detail and covered some pretty concerning evidence about the higher risks of violence, abuse, neglect, and exploitation that people can be subject to when they're living in these settings. But these are folks for whom the NDIS was supposed to be transformational. We were supposed to be seeing more of better than and different rather than more of the same. But by and large, that isn't what's happened so far. People are still in the same settings. 4 out of 5 people that transferred into the NDIS in their group homes are still in the same group homes that they were in before the NDIS started, and they haven't seen any significant improvement. So they're not getting a good deal, but nor are taxpayers, to be honest, George, because this is a small part of the scheme. It's only 7% of scheme participants, but the cost is 37% of the total. That's $15 billion in the last financial year. And Grattan isn't saying that this should cost less, certainly not. These are folks that are always going to need a lot of support from the scheme, but they should be getting much better quality and much better results, frankly, for that price tag than they're currently getting. So getting the NDIS working right for this group, we think, and we argue in our report, really should be the litmus test for any government that's trying to get the NDIS back on track. And we show in our research that it can be done better. We look at other parts of the world where there are innovative alternatives to group homes available to a much greater extent than they are in Australia. There are pockets of great stuff in Australia, and I'm sure we'll hear lots about that from Nicole today as well. But it doesn't have to be this way. Group homes are not inevitable, and our work has shown that they can be as cost effective, if not cheaper in some cases, than group homes. So there really is no excuse. We really do need to look at how we do better by this group of NDIS participants.
Oh, 100%. And what I really appreciate about your report is that it does say that there are better ways, and it does tell the government what are some really practical things that they can be doing to help people to be able to do alternatives and get them into better outcomes. I want to talk a bit about these alternatives to group homes. Can you just give us a bit of an overview of some of those?
Certainly, George, yeah. So we talk a lot in our report about what we're calling individualised living arrangements. And that's really a catch-all term for a lot of different ways of supporting people with quite intensive needs in ways that differ from group homes in three main ways, really. First is that it involves people being supported in ordinary homes in the community with people they've chosen to live with. Second is that they are not forced to share supports by virtue of that arrangement. And third, that these arrangements are still really cost effective, in large part because they rely on a lot of different kinds of support to make them work, rather than just formal support, by which I mean paid support worker time that's paid by the hour. And what we say in our report is we're making a really strong case for what we're calling semi-formal support. So at the moment, the NDIS relies heavily, particularly for this group, on formal support. And in group homes, that's rostered support workers coming in to make sure people in the home have got the support that they need throughout the day and at night. And if people are lucky, they've also got some informal supports, and the NDIS can make the most of those as well. But what we don't see is what we're calling semi-formal support. And that's the kind of support that happens by virtue of where someone chooses to live and with whom, whether that's in the home of a host who might be a family or an individual who's welcoming someone into their home and to share their family life, or whether it might be in someone's own home, whether that's rented or it's owned, where they get some support from a housemate. These are folks that want to provide support, but they need some reimbursement of the costs of doing so. And this is something you really don't see much in the NDIS at the moment. Two of the things that we found were the most common arrangements that fall into this category were hosts. So I've mentioned that already, where someone moves into the home of a host family and gets support in that way. But also this housemate model, which we think has a huge amount of potential, where people are getting some support from a housemate in a rented property or in somewhere that they own. And we're not saying that these kinds of supports can replace formal support for everybody all of the time. But we are saying that when you have these kinds of arrangements, you get some fantastic benefits. People are less dependent on paid support. They have more unpaid relationships in their lives. They're cost effective, but they're also just better suited to delivering some of the really important outcomes of the NDIS. Because if you're getting support in an ordinary home in the community, then being connected to that community, having independence and making a contribution is just all an awful lot easier.
Very, very interesting. And I love, Nicole, that your organisation, you specialise in doing this work. Can you talk us through what you actually do, and help us to understand how it works and how people end up with good outcomes.
Yeah, I'd love to, George. So I guess Sam went into the overview of what some of these approaches are in his report, and we're really pleased that they've been captured and that this report is going to be published. My place have been around since 1996, and we've been supporting individuals to live in host approaches since 1998. So we've been doing this for quite a while. At the moment, we support approximately 400 people, as I mentioned earlier. And of those 400 people, 60 individuals choose to live in host arrangements. So I guess I'll start by talking about that, because that's probably the most common of the semi-formal approaches that my place are involved in. So host approaches typically appeal to individuals who want to move in with a person or people that they get along well with, that can provide a safe and comfortable home for them. Typically, but not always, these individuals don't need active overnight support, but as Sam talked about, sometimes supports that are needed that are more active, like wake supports, can be complemented by paid assistance where it's needed. They're a volunteer arrangement, and it's a really essential element to the success of these approaches. I've received consent from a couple of individuals my place work with, who are keen to share their stories. So I'd love to chat about them if you want to hear about them.
I'd love to hear about them.
Yeah, great. So there's an individual we support. I'm going to call him Edward for today. He lives in a host arrangement in Perth. He's been living with his hosts, who are a married couple, for 6 years now. Prior to that, Edward lived in another really successful host approach in Perth. His dad, so his approach is actually something we call shared management, which means his dad employs all of his paid employees and supervises, I guess, his team, including his host supports, to make sure that the arrangement suits Edward's needs. Edward's 50. As I said, he lives with a couple. They're also of a similar age. They've got kids that have grown up and moved out of home. And the approach just works incredibly well. So prior to Edward moving in with hosts, he lived in a group home, and that really didn't work for him. He struggled to not have control over the people that were providing support with him and the people that he lived with, and that resulted in some behaviours of concern, some physical aggression. When Edward was supported to move into a host approach and he was able to have kind of individualised support and choose what his environment looked like and felt like for him, his behaviours of concern actually were eradicated, so he no longer has or requires a behaviour support plan. So I think that's a really positive example of, I guess, just one of many, many approaches. I've got more if you want to hear a couple more examples.
Can we talk about that? Because, we talk about behaviours of concern, and these are real responses to situations that people are unhappy and where, we're not being heard. So when we address the problem or the unhappiness or the lack of control, of course people's behaviors of concern are gonna reduce. And I just think that, that illustration of yours, where this person suddenly moved to an arrangement where he decided who supports him and how that works, That's what we want for everyone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, 100%, George. I think, I don't know about you, but I've definitely lived in shared living arrangements where when you get a housemate that isn't necessarily your jam and you don't connect with them well, it can have huge impacts on whether you want to go home. Do you know, it impacts everything. Home should be a safe space. So, yeah.
And often what I hear is that there's group homes where there's a bunch of people who haven't chosen to live together, that it does become a pressure cooker, so that everyone's unhappiness feeds off one another. And that isn't what we want from our NDIS. We want people to be happy and have social control, which is what the NDIS is meant to be about.
Absolutely. And even from an economical point of view, you know, when someone is experiencing unhappiness and communicating that through behaviours of concern, they require increased support, which, you know, requires money. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. I'd love to chat about Kevin. He's another individual who lives in a host approach in regional WA. He's 60 years old. He was also in congregate care, and he actually was supported by one of the support workers in the group home he lived in. She identified that he was really unhappy. She connected with his family, and together they made a plan to help him transition out of the group home. He moved in with her, and he lived incredibly happily with her for 18 years. He also was living in Metro, and he'd been born and raised in country WA. The reason he moved to Metro was because that's where the group home was. So she purchased a property that was on country so that he could move, you know, back out of Metro so that he could be where he had always wanted to live. Recently, they lived really happily together for 18 years, and recently she decided that she wanted to go travelling. So she helped him trial some respite host approaches. He met a couple that he really connected with, and he had a gradual transition to eventually move in with them. So now he's living again in regional Western Australia with a couple that he's really well settled with. So I guess that's a good example that these arrangements might not be forever, but often living arrangements aren't forever for individuals. Yeah. But when you connect with the right people, they can be really stable, offer consistency and be long term.
Is there anything that you can tell us about how does people decide that they want to do this, and also how are they supported?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess your first question, how are we helping individuals to find appropriate hosts? Look, it's a slow process. I have to be really honest that this isn't something that anyone should jump into and think that they'll find the right person immediately. On very rare instances that happens. But I guess it's like finding a suitable housemate. You have to find a person that you can connect with. You have to find a home in an area that you want to live in. That's something that My Place supports individuals to do. The individuals, I guess, hear about these opportunities largely through word of mouth. If I'm honest, I think people meet people that are doing these sorts of approaches and they put their hands up. It's not uncommon for support workers to actually transition into a host approach. So we support, I know of, you know, several people that have been in group homes and they now live with their hosts who were support workers at the time. So that's kind of a nice, I don't know, story, where people get to transition through people that were already known to them and who knew them well, but also identified that perhaps their previous living arrangements weren't suited to them. In terms of the arrangement for the hosts, I guess it's very much a lifestyle role and a volunteer role. These individuals live in their own homes and have someone moving in with them. And they can look, you know, a myriad of ways. It can be an individual person, a family with kids in the home, a couple. It really depends on the person with the disability and what they want in a host approach and what will work for them. The hosts can access a subsidy for costs. These can include tangible costs such as physical space, wear and tear of the home, covering food, drink, laundry, recreational activities, and transport. But more so, the subsidy covers those intangible costs, such as the disruption to someone's general life, sharing your home with an individual, which is, I guess, likened to having a flatmate, the provision of social connection and community, which is kind of priceless, but it's definitely something that is essential to the success of the host approach, which Sam touched on earlier. I don't know, Sam, if you wanted to add to that.
Michael, that's really interesting. Is there a payment that the NDIS pays the person that's not taxable? How does it work on a practical level? And Sam, feel free to explain as well from your research.
Yeah, as we were saying earlier, semi-formal supporters, they're not paid by the hour. This isn't the same way that people that are doing support work are compensated. They need to be reimbursed, though, for the costs that they accrue as a result of the support that they're providing. And this is possible under the NDIS now. Through our research, we found there was no legislative change that is needed. And indeed, people might be aware that people under the NDIS at the moment can do something called individualised living options. And as part of that, there is the ability to pay a reimbursement that covers the kinds of costs that we're talking about. And that can be to a host, whether that's a family or an individual or a couple, as Nicole was talking about. But it can also be to a housemate to cover the cost of the support they're providing, and that can go to covering their rent as well.
Really interesting that you mentioned the individualised living option, Sam, because that's already part of the NDIS. I did a podcast on it about 3 or 4 years ago now. Do you know if these IRA options are being taken up, and if they're not, what's the barrier to that happening? Sam?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think it's ever been a strategic priority is the first thing I would say. A lot of people in the group that we're talking about, as we said earlier, they transferred into the scheme, really just moving from the state ledger to the NDIS ledger in their group homes. They didn't get alternatives offered to them. And the agency, for all of the period that was happening, was focused, perhaps for some understandable reasons, on transitioning the hundreds of thousands of people that were getting support for the first time into the NDIS. So making sure folks in this kind of part of the scheme have more choices and options really hasn't been something that there's been the bandwidth to think about up to now, other than through band-aid solutions to supported independent living to make sure that we're trying to manage the costs within that type of environment. And I think the decision making as well has also continued to channel people into group homes. There's an assumption that when someone has very high needs, they're going to need a lot of support worker time. And if that's what your mindset is, it becomes important consideration to think about, well, how are those support costs shared? And that's why group homes exist in the first place, really. They provide that economy of scale for sharing supports. But we've shown in our report that isn't the only way to deliver these supports efficiently. So the decision making here really needs to catch up with the reality. And I think the other point I would make is that what we call market stewardship in the NDIS, it's really been a little undercooked up to now. Outside of the things that the agency's done in thin markets in remote Australia to try and make sure that there are supports available for people, there's not been a lot done to really shape the market that we want to see. And people have perhaps expected that the market will evolve in response to individual purchasing decisions. But when you're talking about people in this group, that really hasn't happened. These are folks with chronically low expectations and with little idea of the various options that might be available. So again, we say that government really needs to lean in to shape the market more if we want to progressively move away from institutional models of support. History tells us it won't just happen. We actually need a plan and we need to implement it.
Indeed. Nicole?
Yeah, George, I guess going back to your comment about ILOs, I was really fortunate to work with the NDIS in the co-design of the ILOs, as was Darren Ginnelly, the managing director of My Place. It was a real collaboration in setting up ILOs, and we were incredibly excited about it at the time because I guess we recognised that ILO was a vehicle that allowed hundreds of the individuals that My Place support to transition smoothly into the NDIS because they were and had been for a long time living in their own homes in individualised setups. So, yeah, we were really excited about it. It worked really well for us. I was doing conference circuits talking to people about ILO. We thought it would be this great kind of, I guess, yeah, element of the NDIS and that it would take off. Unfortunately, and for reasons which are unclear to us, indexation of ILOs didn't come through in the NDIS price guide review a couple of years ago. That's resulted in My Place largely being prevented from continuing to offer this to individuals and people with disability in Western Australia. The majority of the individuals who initially had been, I guess, set up under ILOs with their NDIS plans, unfortunately, went through reviews and plan changes and had to move away from ILO or ILA, I guess. So they've had funding. And I can't speak on behalf of everyone, but we've definitely seen a trend away from ILOs to move into FlexiCore so that individuals can have their plans indexed, which is absolutely essential at the moment with the cost of living.
So what you're saying is the NDIA or the government shot themselves in the foot by disincentivizing an option that is better for people and also costs less, and incentivize the more expensive option. Well, what happened there, Sam? Why is this madness continuing?
Yeah, it is crazy, George, I would say. It's really frustrating, I should add, you know, from a research perspective as well, because what it means is that the NDIS data really isn't very much use in telling us how many people have got creative individualized arrangements at the moment, because really good providers we spoke to, they're making this work, but they're doing so in spite of the system at the moment rather than because of it. People are doing some great things, but they're finding ways around all of the barriers essentially that are in the way. So ILO was never really promoted. Nicole's just said that the pricing was set up in a way that it really wasn't going to be viable for many people. So they're opting to use other support items in the NDIS flexibly. And that's great. If you can make that work, that's fantastic. But really, and this is an area where I would agree with what the NDIS review said about this, it's all proved too hard, too complex. People see barriers in the way of doing this rather than frameworks that enable them to really run with this idea. And they should have help to make this work rather than having to overcome so many of these barriers just to get the things that make a lot of sense, both in terms of people living an ordinary life, but also for the taxpayer, because the bottom line, as we've shown in our research, is that these arrangements can be delivered really efficiently if they're set up well.
Yeah, that was clear. The other thing that I really liked about your report is that you had an international perspective, and that you looked at the kinds of innovation that is going on around the world. Can you talk us through some of the more interesting and exciting innovative approaches that you've uncovered in your report, Sam?
Yeah, sure, George. We start quite wide with this in our report. We talk about innovation in the housing, so how that is configured. We also talk about innovation in how the support is provided. That's probably the main place that we focus in the report. But we also touch on innovation in how technology is really optimized within these kinds of arrangements. And I think, again, that's another area where there's a huge amount of potential that's untapped in the NDIS at the moment. And some of that's pretty basic, but effective. So we looked at, within Australia, there's an out-of-hours on-call service, if you like, that's offered by Spinal Cord Injuries Australia in parts of New South Wales. There's a support worker that's on call. They can come to somebody's home. They've got a 15-minute response time anytime between 6 p.m. and 5 a.m. the following morning. And that means someone can get services overnight, and that can be very basic things like you've forgotten to turn the gas off and you need someone to help with that, or it can be a catheter change or something that requires a more skilled intervention. And it enables people to live independently but without having a support worker asleep on site in the other room. And the biggest thing that service provides really is peace of mind for people. We found talking to them that the service is quite underutilized, but people just need to know that it's there. Then you've also got some examples that are a bit more involved, like some forms of telecare and remote support in the US. These use remote monitoring technology to facilitate service delivery for people, usually people with a cognitive or an intellectual disability. Can be things like sensors in the home or passive or real-time monitoring. And you can imagine that so long as that's done in a way that protects someone's privacy within agreed boundaries, then it could really help people to live independently with a safety net that they can rely on. And then in terms of the support aspect, the semi-formal supports we've been talking about, that they're available to a much greater extent in other parts of the world than they are in Australia at the moment. You've got more than 10,000 people in the UK, mostly people with intellectual disabilities, so very much the same cohort that we're talking about, who are being supported in shared lives arrangements. That's the language they use for hosts, whether full-time or on a respite basis. UK government's just invested a lot more money in growing that because they see that it has more potential than it's got right now. We've got people in home share arrangements in British Columbia to an extent now that over the last 15 years, that's replaced the group home model entirely as the predominant way that people are supported. More than 4,000 people in a place only the quarter the size of Australia from population terms are being supported really well in those kind of arrangements with a housemate living in the community at the moment. And then there are other things like the keyring model in the UK or the good neighbour model, which I think happens in WA to an extent, as well as in Canada, where someone in the community gets some reimbursement for support that they might provide to people within the community, whether that's in the same complex or just living nearby. They monitor the well-being of people in that community, act as a safety net, really, to make sure that they're getting the support that they need. So there's lots of things that the NDIS could be looking at. And our report argues that it's likely to be these things in combination in future that are really going to deliver the best results and the most cost-effective services for people. It's just not happening as much as it should do right now.
We need to get it happening. I'm interested. What are some of the legislative changes that you think that we need to make this happen? I mean, Nicole, I know that you're in WA, and this is something that's a lot more common in WA. And Sam, you had statistics that showed that group homes are far less common in WA. What do you think we need to do to ensure that we can enable people to have this more flexible and innovative support across the whole country? Any thoughts on that? I'll start with you, Sam.
Well, what you've highlighted is really important. You're absolutely right. The research shows that in WA, the number of people in group homes is just much lower than it is everywhere else. We also see many more people in the kinds of arrangements that Nicole's been talking about, and that's fantastic. And it's the result of deliberate policy choices by the WA government over a period of time. It's certainly the case that there are a range of individualised arrangements that are just easier to deliver in WA, and that's because of particular industrial relations frameworks. It's because of the sorts of things that government decided to invest in, going right back to the 1990s. But our research, when we've looked at these housemate and home share type models, we've seen that there's no big legal changes needed for those. There's no big legislative agenda for change here. What it really needs is prioritisation and conviction, really, from all parties. And effectively, you know, to some extent, this is already NDIS policy, on paper at least, because we've had this ILO policy. We have a home and living framework that's promised. We have a demonstration program to look at alternative ways of doing things. But we've got to stop this being something people struggle to do as opposed to something that they have help to do. And it's an issue of mixed messages to some extent. We want innovation, but we want people to have real choices, but we'll not promote it. We'll make this really hard and we'll keep funding the opposite. So the policy change that we think we need is really just getting serious about how we want to change the NDIS in ways that it can service this important group differently. And you need to get the funding model right for that. You need to get the promotion right. You need to develop resources and best practice frameworks that can grow capability for providers, for families. We need to probably pilot and evaluate how this works and how it can be spread most effectively. And we definitely need to target particular cohorts, people living at home with family at the moment that are on a pathway into more institutional support than they need to have at the moment if the NDIS doesn't change, and also offering those choices to people that are in group homes that have been there for a long time. So I guess our argument, George, is yes, there are peculiar and, you know, really fantastic specific things about the WA context, which Nicole can talk to you about, but it's not those that are absolutely integral to making this fly. Hosts and housemates, absolutely possible in the scheme at the moment, doesn't need legislative change, needs conviction and prioritisation by the scheme.
I love that, Sam. Nicole?
Yeah, that was really well said, Sam. Look, I'm from Victoria. I've heard all of the jokes about Western Australia before I moved over here, like WA stands for wait a while. So I was incredibly and pleasantly surprised when I moved over here and saw how innovative Western Australia was in terms of individualised supports. I'd come from Department of Human Services in the disability sector in Vic, and yeah, look, they kind of had me very early on. I think the reason that we see more people living in their own homes is for a really long time, the state have been committed to innovative solutions that afford people with disability control and flexibility over their own homes. I think that individuals have been living in their own homes. As I said, my place has been around 28 years, so we've supported a lot of people to live in their own homes. We were doing it before the NDIS rolled into town. So I guess those people were very, very firm that they were not going to give up what they'd fought really hard for, no matter what was thrown at them. I think that on a national level, we need to stop having barriers put up. For example, we talked about ILO before. We thought that that was a really great initiative, and then when it was ruled out of receiving indexation, basically had a circle put around it, which nothing else did. It prevented that from being a successful tool for individuals to use. So, yeah.
So, Sam, the concerns around industrializations, can you address that? Is that, it sounds like you're saying that isn't a real concern.
Yeah, look, there are some things that are quite distinct about Western Australia's industrial relations framework. They're not things that are relevant for the host and housemates models that we've been talking about primarily. But there's a lot of other things that it's possible for people with disability in Australia, in WA, to do that is not the same in other jurisdictions. And that's largely because there are some specific provisions that mean that when people are employing people to work in their own household, it's a private and domestic arrangement, they're able to employ them at rates that are different than those that exist under the SHADS award. So at a sort of lower rate, essentially. And that makes all sorts of other kinds of support more affordable than they might be in other jurisdictions.
I don't think that it's even called to ask if there are any pitfalls or risks or things that people should be aware of with these more semi-formal and innovative approaches.
Yeah, sure, George. Look, I think it's important to note that these approaches are not for everyone. Just like any kind of approach, I guess sharing a home with somebody, moving into a home with somebody will work for some individuals, not for others. So it's essential, I guess, that each individual has absolute choice and control over who it is that they're going to be living with. These approaches do make that more possible. Not only do they get to choose who they live with, but they get to choose where they're living and who's coming in and out of the home. I think that it's really important to point out that these approaches can't be the be-all and end-all. They can't be a stopgap. I guess a lot of these arrangements also require the individuals having some paid supports to make them sustainable and successful, and Sam's report has really outlined that well. I think that obviously in the current climate, the availability of suitable properties can have an impact on the success of the good neighbour approach. But on the flip side of that, these approaches are also an excellent solution, especially where you're moving in with an individual without a disability who has a home in this current climate where there's a housing crisis. So, while where there's pitfalls, there's also some huge pros. I think that people who are utilising these approaches, whether that's service providers or individuals, they need to be live to the legal and the technical implications and make sure that they're, I guess, staying true to the approaches and making sure that the individuals that are providing these supports are still able to live, I guess, a natural and a typical life, because there becomes a point in, I guess, providing support where it could move into what should be paid employment. And it's really important that if something looks like employment, it's, you know, it's treated like employment, recognises employment, and people are paid. So these approaches are voluntary and they're very, very different. So it's essential, I guess, that people treat them that way and respect that.
Yeah, that's really interesting because when we, you know, part of what this is saying is saying semi-formal. So once you enter that semi-formal space, you can sometimes move towards something that's a bit more formal. And if it's formal, then it needs to be remunerated and treated that way, like you said. So just negotiating that and informing people about it is really what needs to happen. And is that what your organisation does?
So, look, we work with individuals to, one, understand what sort of approach they want, identify what that might look like, including who they want to live with. We provide ongoing maintenance and support. Look, these sorts of living arrangements require a lot of ongoing maintenance. Like any kind of living arrangement, I think that living with someone doesn't just happen easily and smoothly. There's work that needs to go into that. So my place works with individuals to make sure that they're continuing to have choice and control, that they're happy and safe in their home. And where there are issues that arise in these living arrangements, we offer guidance to individuals to kind of navigate their way through that. I think we talked about it earlier, but it's essential that there's careful selection and time invested in these approaches. Without that, and without the ongoing nurturing, there's risk, I guess. But the success of these approaches from lots of individuals that live in these arrangements, I think, far outweigh the risk.
Can you give us a couple more stories from your experience?
Yeah, sure. So I talked a little bit earlier about host approaches. Sam's talked about flatmates, so I'm happy to share the arrangement of an individual my place supports. She's given consent for me to chat about her living situation. So there's a young woman, her name is Soraya. She lives in Margaret River. Her parents have built her a beautiful home, which they did through a initiative called Keystart. So it's basically a shared equity initiative. Soraya owns 62% of the home, and the Keystart, which was set up, I believe, by Disability Services Commission, own 38% of the home. Soraya uses her pension to pay down her share of the mortgage. She has a part of the home, it was purpose-built, that's set up for, I guess, a flatmate to move in with her. That flatmate provides companionship and support to Soraya. Soraya has seizures, so that flatmate is available to provide support during the night when and if Soraya needs that. But Soraya doesn't necessarily need someone on hand, you know, every hour receiving paid support. So this arrangement works really, really well, both for Soraya and for her flatmate. I was actually chatting to Soraya's mum this week, and she was chatting about how it's all going, and she said that basically it's been a long journey. She said when it works, it's really brilliant. When it doesn't, you have to hold on to the vision. It's hard and it's tempting to move into rostering, but it's well worth holding on to, which I thought was really powerful. So Soraya's mum's name's Leanne. She also said that there are a million and one things that get in your way when you're kind of navigating your way through this space, but you push through it and it's all worth it without question in the end. So look, Soraya and Leanne and the family have been on a journey. Even getting approval for the shared equity, I think, was a journey for them. But Soraya's now settled and really well established in her home with a long-term flatmate, and it's all working really well. So that's a nice example.
That's a great story. And what I love about this, and I just thought the report as well, it's saying that, you know, the group home approach was really around segregating people and putting them altogether and saving money that way. But these innovative models are about having people in the community, having relationships with people who do and don't have disability, And as a result of that, all kinds of other opportunities can evolve, right? Have you found that, Nicole?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Leanne was talking about the fact that the flatmate has brought Soraya's, has brought her own family and friends into Soraya's world. So Soraya has this huge community network now. She has had a flatmate previously, and, you know, they got to a point in time where they wanted to move out and get into their own home. And I think it's important to recognise that these approaches might not be forever, which is also typical of a lot of shared homes. But Soraya stays connected with her past flatmate. She still has those networks in her life. She lives in a small community where she's, you know, really well connected with lots of people because of these approaches, which, you know, is absolutely beautiful. I've got, I guess, another example I can share. Sam talked a little bit about Good Neighbour earlier. So Good Neighbour is where someone that's living close by to an individual with a disability is engaged to provide support and guidance on a voluntary basis, and they might receive a contribution in kind for those supports. We support a woman called Heather. She's in her 40s, and she has a neighbour that lives nearby, Felicia, who's been living near Heather for about 3.5 years. Heather used to live in a group home. She's another person that's transitioned from a group home. She was really vulnerable in the group home, which put her at risk. She moved into her own home. Initially, I understand she had 24/7 support in her home, and she was very, very clear that she did not want to share her home. She wanted her own space. That resulted in her at times locking her supports out of her home, which put her at immense risk. The Good Neighbour approach was pitched to Heather and trialled, and it works really, really well because there's someone, they actually live on the same block but in separate houses. Heather has very much her own space, control over her domain. She can pick and choose when that good neighbour comes into her home, and she actually sees her daily. They spend a couple of hours together a day, but it's very much an informal and more natural kind of advice and guidance relationship. And, yeah, Heather's just flourished and, you know, lives in her own home like a typical individual should and can and does.
So I might ask you, the legislation has passed around changes to the NDIS. Are there going to be these draft lists of things that you can and can't buy with your NDIS funds? Can I have your perspective on whether or not these lists will support the more innovative approaches, or whether they will put up more barriers?
Thanks, George. I mean, there's things in the legislative changes that will support some of the things that we're suggesting in our report. And then there are some that are a bit problematic, potentially. So, you know, where we end up on some of that will be important. On the positive side, we propose in our report that in place of the current process where people submit reams of evidence and they wait to see what supports they've been granted, that a budget is provided early in the process based on an assessment of need, so that people can plan with an understanding of what money they've got available. And that's the way many comparable systems of self-directed support the world over operate. And I think it holds some great promise in enabling more creative use of funding in the NDIS if it's designed well. So there are some good things. On the sort of not so sure side, we obviously have that current consultation you've referred to on the lists of NDIS supports. We think it's going to be really important that the reimbursement payment to a host, to a housemate, to support an individualised living arrangement to remain viable, sometimes to partly or fully cover the cost of a housemate's rent. That needs to be an option for people for all of the reasons that we've talked about on this podcast. So it will be very important that that's retained as an option, that there's a carve out, whatever it is, that doesn't undermine that as a choice for people, because it should be there for all of the reasons we've discussed. But more than that, we also make the case in our report for a new rental subsidy to be provided to people as a means of leaving a group home if they want to, or when people have intensive needs for in-home supports but don't currently qualify for an SDA category. And that's an alternative to what the NDIS review recommended, which was a new SDA category, your listeners might recall, that facilitates the sharing of supports. We think that risks entrenching the group home model for another generation. It'd be far better to get people a leg up on the rental market, to be able to live in ordinary homes with the types of individualized arrangements that we talk about in our report and that Nicole's been talking about so eloquently that are available in WA for many people. That would require some changes to the legislation as well, so that there is the ability for people in particular circumstances to have access to that kind of a payment that helps them to live in an ordinary home. And we think that's a really sensible thing to do for the NDIS, I should add, because the benefits of stable housing, they're going to accrue to the NDIS in terms of the benefits of stable and sustainable support costs, which is really where the lion's share of the costs in the scheme are for these folks. So there's a very good reason to be thinking about that as well.
Absolutely. We need these lists to be based on principles and not on a checklist. And I think from what we've heard today, that ruling out rental payments will essentially make a lot of these more innovative solutions impossible. Sam, you also recommend a housing and living navigator. This is also in the review. Why do you think this role's crucial? It sounds similar to the work that Nicole's been doing in supporting people, but how might it be different?
No, it is similar in a way. I mean, essentially what we're saying is that people in the scheme, particularly people that need intensive housing and living supports from the NDIS, they just need more information, they need more advice than they currently get. They need help to understand what options might be available, to think about what would work best for them within their local area. And that is not what they get at the moment in the scheme. But we think these navigators would connect people to organisations like My Place, to capacity building organisations, to peer support, to mentoring, to other advocacy and whatever else is needed, so that people have support to make decisions, to understand what it is that might be possible. Because people do have really low expectations of that. And if you don't know that something's possible, then you're really likely just to continue to perpetuate the current pattern. And we need to break that pattern. And we think that needs a much stronger range of supports for people to navigate the system, not just to connect to different services, but to build their expectations of what a good life looks like, and to work with providers to make sure that they're developing the capability to offer different things as well.
Calling back to the chat we had earlier where I talked about Soraya, who lives in Margaret River in her own home, her mum mentioned that she had no idea that Soraya had, you know, opportunities to live anywhere other than in the family home or in a group home, until one day she went to a talk and a parent was talking about the fact that their son was had been supported to move into his own home. And she said that they talked about the son's disabilities, and she recognised that if they could do that, then Soraya could do it too. And she said from that day a seed was planted, and she just knew that she had to fight no matter what to kind of follow that pathway for Soraya. But I agree, like, it's so important that people know that these arrangements and approaches are possible and available, and hopefully the legislation can support these to continue and to improve.
I love that. I mean, you can't be what you can't see, and I've seen a lot of examples of where, you know, people go to an event, they hear another person in a similar situation saying how they did something that was innovative and it worked, and it kind of does go, oh, hang on, why haven't I thought of that? And maybe I can do that. And I'm hoping that for people listening to this podcast, it's hopefully sparked a few people to go, yeah, maybe I'll find out more about this. So what can people do if they're listening and they're interested in taking some steps around more flexible and innovative housing? Nicole?
Look, whilst we're in Western Australia, My Place are always happy to talk to individuals who are exploring opportunities. So they're more than welcome to contact us. There are some great organisations over here that would also be open, I'm sure, to chatting to individuals about the opportunities that are out there. We also work with families that I have no doubt would be keen to share their journeys and their stories with people. So, yeah, people are welcome to reach out.
Fantastic. Sam, any final thoughts from you?
I guess my final thought, George, would be that the NDIS, it is transformational. It is a great program, but it needs to be better than it is at the moment. There's a huge amount of anxiety in the community about all of the changes that are afoot, and that's entirely understandable to an extent. But if government can galvanise people around making the scheme work right for this group, who really need it most, no one's going to dispute that, and to start properly addressing the in-tray of deinstitutionalisation and continuing that journey, then I think that's an important goal and aspiration, and everyone can get behind that, as well as it being a really vital contribution to making the scheme sustainable into the future. So this is an opportunity to do something really meaningful and worthwhile, and I hope government listens to that.
Absolutely, so do I. Nick, how are your final thoughts?
Yeah, look, I second what Sam said. I think that on the back of the Royal Commission report, which really does emphasise that the risks of congregate care, living in an individualised approach should absolutely be, you know, a choice for anyone. I think that as Sam's report highlights, these approaches aren't necessarily more expensive. They're cost comparative, in my opinion, which backed up by the Royal Commission report, they're safer. And most importantly, individuals get to decide who they live with, where they live, who's coming into their home, how they're supported, and even when they want to utilise their support. Having one-on-one support means that you don't have to roster when you're going to have a shower. You're not waiting in a queue to go to the bathroom. When I talk to families that are considering coming across, or individuals who are considering moving into their own home, and we're supporting them to do that, some families, it takes a while for them to understand, I don't have to lock in social and community. It can happen anytime an individual wants it. What? That's mind-blowing, but it isn't, and it shouldn't be. It should just be, you know, part of anybody's life to be able to go to the shops when they want to. So yeah, look, I'm just obviously a huge advocate of individualized living arrangements for individuals, and I hope that the NDIS continue to make this a real possible option for anybody.
Absolutely. I love this move that we need to make, that we need to stop thinking about, you know, one particular solution. We need a lot more different approaches, and approaches that support people to live in a community and be surrounded by people that have similar interests, that want to live their lives just regular like everyone else. And I'm so pleased that we were able to shine a light on some of that today, and I hope that there's some people listening that will go, yeah, let's give it a go, and I hope that the government is listening, and that we make sure that the policies and the procedures around the NDIS and the legislation facilitates these kind of innovative and worthwhile arrangements. So thank you personally for your time. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks so much for having us, George.
Thanks, George. It's been a pleasure.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Visible and Necessary. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts with us in the comment section below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.